slide a little bit.
Okay, so in a way, I will just somehow try to complement the view from the completely other side, which Hans-Peter has just come up with.
Okay.
Namely, I will speak about making ultra-cold molecules with confinement. And before I start, and in the end, I acknowledge the contributions of the group. And for this project, especially Simon Sala and Philipp Schneider, two PhD students, extremely bright ones. And I will come to a collaboration with the Selim Jochen group. And okay, so as I said, my view comes from the view body physics. So I will just come the other way around. For me, molecules in an optical lattice means I have maybe one molecule or two atoms which form a molecule, and they are in some sites of some confinement potential. Yeah, so I will build up typically the optical lattice from below, from one site, two sites, three sites, maybe four sites, eight sites, nine sites, something like this. So it's an opposite direction, and I hope that I can convince you that this is an interesting view to come from to the microscopic picture, exactly what Hans-Peter was mentioning. Unfortunately, it was in it behind the blackboard, that, on the blackboard behind the screen, that you have, of course, this problem sometimes to get microscopic parameters. And one way, we have heard, is an elegant way. You just cancel them out and say they are not relevant. And the other view is, of course, to try to calculate them. Okay. Now, I will speak about influence of confinement. Then I will try to bridge a little bit the many-body to many-body physics by deriving parameters like Bose-Hubbard parameters from microscopic calculations. And then I will mostly speak about confinement in resonances, namely the idea to produce molecules. But I will speak first about resolving the puzzle, because there was a lot of confusion with this confinement in resonances. And probably I will not have time to speak about few particles in 1D optical lattices, so optical lattices, which is some work we do, some analytic work we do, which is fun to do Hubbard and beyond Hubbard in 1D, where even we can solve things. Okay, now optical lattices I do not have to discuss, I think, here. It's clear that we have these different dimensionalities, and especially interesting for us will be these one dimensional tubes, because this will be for the confinement resonances really the main geometry, but there's also some pancake geometry, but I will not really too explicitly go on this. Okay, now just as I said, short wrap up, why is view body physics, in my opinion, of interest? Because if you have a mod state with one or two atoms or molecules, one atom per side, then you have an isolated addressable quantum system. So this is interesting for quantum information, as you know. It protects against collisions. Two atoms, you can make controlled interactions, so it's a reaction chamber. And if you have, of course, diatomic molecules with heteronuclear diatomic molecules, you have a dipole moment, and we have heard a lot about for quantum simulation. To my understanding, it's of course nice to think of these objects as just tools, some pieces which have some properties which I like. They are delta function potential interactions or something like this. But I would like to understand whether this is really always true. And whether where is, so to speak, the border where you have to bother about the microscopic picture. So that's our main intention. We really want to understand the few body system in optical lattice, the static and the dynamic properties. So for me, one of the central issues is in this quantum information, projected applications, quantum simulations, or even quantum computers, is the reliability of the mapping you are doing. And so, for example, you make the magnetic field mapping, in a magnetic flashbulb resonance, on the scattering lengths by an effective potential. But this is normally, or was originally obtained for free atom pairs from free scattering theory. Now, optical lattice means you have confined atoms. It's not free space. What happens then in flashbulb resonances in tight harmonic traps? This is something we have been bothering a lot last years. Now, the other thing is, of course, if you map it on some model, like the Bose-Hubbard Ising or whatever, or we have heard beautiful models just before, then, of course, the question is really, what do you map on? Yeah, what is your microscopic world you try to describe? And one of the main things is that you do not have even a harmonic trap, which Hans-Peter already said is quite difficult for dipoles, but you have actually a multicenter situation, and so you have a coupling of center of mass and relative motion. So the question always is, do we really simulate what we think we simulate, or at some point our microscopic picture or mapping to the microscopic world breaks down, and we in fact we see something, but this is due to a breakdown of the assumption we have on the microscopic world. So this is why I think it's important to consider this more carefully. Now the theoretical challenge is that we have to start with a non-trivial, non-analytic atom-atom interactions. So it's not like the Coulomb interaction, which is tough, but we know a lot of to do with because it's analytically known. Here we normally know Born-Oppenheimer potential curves, which already are an approximation. So a magnetic Feshbach resonance is in reality a multi-scale, multi-channel problem. It's not just two channels or whatever, yeah, or a delta function with a prefactor, which varies. Yeah, so what we did, we wrote our own multi-channel error matrix code for that. Now, of course, you know that normally we model these atom-atom interactions based on the idea of very old ideas of nuclear physics and solid-state physics. So we say that, of course, for many problems, we don't bother about the details on the short range, and we are only interested in the long-range part. And then, of course, if you're lucky, this is a full what we need, and we come to this famous pseudo-potential approximation, which in the ultra-cold atom world means that the real molecular potential curve, assuming one is sufficient, and maybe one Born-Oppenheimer curve is sufficient, goes over in this pseudo-potential, which is basically something of constant times the delta function. Okay, I still insist, although we have gotten used to that, that the pseudo-potential we use is absolutely counterintuitive. We know, of course, how to derive it, I mean, that's clear, but the idea that your long-range behavior is fully designed what happens at zero is very weird. Yeah, and in fact, it leads to some artifacts if you are not careful at some moments, because everything depends on what happens at zero distance. Yeah, with your delta function. Yeah, and this sometimes one has to be careful, and one should always remind that. Yeah,
maybe another way to say it is that things don't depend on how it happens at short distance.
Yes.
Therefore, you can take the simplest possible short distance thing with a delta potential.
I think there's many reasonings why, and it's plausible, as I said, if you just do the Born calculation and you cut off high momenta, do the Fourier transform, you get to it. I don't doubt anything there. I've done it myself. But I come from scattering theory originally, but it's weird. Yeah? And it has some problems in some points. And we have been discussing this in the context of photo association some time ago, but I will not go here. I just remind that, I mean, even a Feshbach resonance in a simple picture, you have only two channels. I mean, this is a well-known picture, I think, to all of you. I mean, your incoming channel of the two atoms, and because of the manipulation of the hyperfine interaction, another state, another hyperfine state, which is practically a copy of the first one, but just vertically offset it, you get into the resonance with this molecular bound state. In reality, you should not forget what you have is a multi-channel reality. This is a resonance we have calculated. This is rubidium. We have 8 coupled channels and very different length scales involved.
In reality, you don't have multiple channels. In reality, you don't have potential.
It's even worse, exactly. I started out with saying that we believe first of all in the Born-Oppenheimer here.
Hervos gave a talk, right? He claims that you need only 2 channels, right? So.
No, we have also made papers on that. We have demonstrated how you need one or how far you can come with one channel and how far you can come with 2 channels. No, we have done this ourselves.
There's only a certain level of approximation.
Exactly.
That's also the Born-Oppenheimer approximation.
Yes.
Approximation.
Okay, so as I said, we have these challenges. One thing was what was bothering us in the beginning was that the magnetic Feshbach resonances were derived for the free space. And we were interested in the influence, at least of a magnetic of the harmonic potential. And so we did some analytical modeling and derived some alternative models, so to speak, to get the magnetic Feshbach resonance in a harmonic trap. And we could recover the known energy relation. We derived an energy-dependent scattering length, which is different from one suggested before, I should say. Of course, we believe in ours. And we think there's a... one can argue that there could be a very easy explanation for the mistake which happened here. So it basically gives you the way to get this shift, the scattering length as a function of energy and magnetic field, from parameters you can obtain experimentally. So that's nice. And you also get the admixture of the closed channel in this model. Absolutely, so as I said, from experimental results. And what we did is we compared this model with a full calculation, the multi-channel calculation, 8-coupled channels, in a harmonic trap with our R-matrix code. And this is the agreement, so the points are the full calculation. The solid line is the model. This is the energy spectrum. This is the admixture of the bound state to the resonance. And you see it varies for the different energy levels. And the deviation is really extremely small. I mean, between a full calculation, multi-channel calculation, harmonic trap, and this model. Just but to give you that there is an effect, which is important. Yes?
So, I mean, compared to the case when you don't have a confinement, right? So how does it compare?
Oh, sorry, I don't have a graph here. But of course, you see the influence. Yes. Sorry, I didn't have a graph here. But it's a matter, I mean, you see it in the next case. You see that there we started out with very small effects. So this is one example of this effect. Sorry?
Yeah, to understand. So you have your model, so that means you take the known result for dependence on scattering length of the
energy. Ours, yes.
So you take the scattering length energy dependent, put it into the known formula for Roth-Feshbach resonance.
Yes.
States and compare it with your full calculation.
Yes. I mean the model I said before from the experimental parameters which are known or measurable. Exactly. And one example, but as I said, it's a very tiny effect.
About the previous slide.
Sorry. Just wanted to answer this question I remember that there was the next slide is answering the effect. So there was, I mean, the point is there was a long-standing debate between Munich and Hamburg about one specific resonance. And the claim was that somehow both were so accurate, I mean, as you see here, yeah, the resonance is very well resolved, but on the level of accuracy they have, they were differing for them much too much. Of course, you see the numbers are extraordinarily small. Yeah? But we get exactly the shift between the two in very good agreement with the results, assuming that in one case you had a tighter optical trap, and this already explains the shift fully. Now, you can try to think about whether there is, so to speak, more effects you see, and one of the interesting I should come back to your question here.
Well, what I was going to ask about was,
yes.
Maybe it's just a trick of the logarithmic scale, but it looked as though at 1067, the contribution from the higher and higher levels didn't drop very quickly.
It's true, because they are closer in a way, in the phase space they are closer, so the overlap is similar. So there's a big drop because of the logarithmic scale, as you correctly say, but then the drop is very slow, and of course what also is interesting, it shifts. So the maximum attribution of the bound state to the resonance is not necessarily at the resonance. Yeah,
And also the picture exactly at the resonance is not as simple as one might think.
Exactly. So the interesting question was whether the shift could become important for, or should become important for large background scattering, and if you have a highly excited state. Now, normally in an ultra-cold gas, you always say we don't have highly excited states, but if you have fermions, you have, because of the Pauli principle. And if you consider this, then there was an experiment, and I just give this with a big question mark, because I know that many people do think that this is not the correct explanation. But just assuming that what they measured here was really with the maximum loss and the resonance position, this shift, which they were surprised about, If we assume that this is due to this effect that the admixture of the resonant bound state is offsetted from the resonance position, and we calculate for their conditions, because it's a highly excited state because of the fermions, we calculate this shift, we get 80 minus 80 Gauss, and they measured minus 80, and we get minus 80.8 Gauss from our model. Okay, as I said, I don't want to claim that this is the effect. There can be macro many body effects really playing a role, but it's at least funny that we get this perfect coincidence. Now, I think I will skip this. There's also, we could explain a Rampe experiment, and an experiment by the group of Rampe, where they also found the losses, and by matching with the resonant bound state, we get perfect agreement with their measurement. So coming back, so the central question, as I said, were the mappings. So the second part would be on the many parameter models like Bose-Hubbard. Now, how do we try to get a microscopic result? So what we set up as a theoretical approach was that we said, OK, we want to treat two atoms in a finite part of an optical lattice. Now, the main conditions we wanted to fulfill was that we wanted to be very flexible on the particle-particle interaction. And therefore, we did something which may sound first a little bit strange, because what we did is we went to center of mass and relative motion. Of course, from the viewpoint of two atoms or particles, this is a natural thing to do. The problem is you lose the separability of the optical lattice even if you have an orthorhombic optical lattice. Yeah? So your Hamiltonian can be written then as a part which depends only on the center of mass, a part which depends only on the relative motion, and a part which gives the coupling between the two. Now we do a Taylor expansion of the sine square lattice. The code is for arbitrary order, our computer not. There's a finite limit, yeah? But we can go to some lattice sites with this. We can have cosine square mixed and fully anisotropic lattices. So what we have is orthorhombic symmetry. So the three Cartesian axes should be, or we have three orthogonal axes, but the lengths of the in the three different directions can be arbitrary. What we do also is, this is not really what we do, but it's easier to say in the beginning. But here, I make a kind of small disclaimer that what we do really is, we put all separable terms here too. Yeah, so it's not a standard Hamiltonian that you would think, because part of this coupling we can move in here, which is due to separable. Then we have a full interatomic interaction potential, which can be given numerically. So you can give us a Born-Oppenheimer potential curve with as many points as you like, and we can put it in. In principle, you can also use two or three. Again, our computer will at some point say, have fun, but I am in holidays now. Okay, so then after we solve this part separately and this part separately, we use those two solutions in a CI or exact diagonalization fashion to couple relative and center of mass motion. Okay, and we have, as I said, a full consideration of the lattice symmetry, of course, included. So we use a full point symmetry of the orthorhombic lattice.
So wait, but I mean, you're still assuming that your optical potential, say, for a molecule is the same as for individual atom, right? But it's not quite true, right? I mean, as we know. Right?
That's a correction we are thinking about of working in, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but in principle, we have the two atoms. I mean, every atom has its potential, and then we do the state expansion. So in that sense, we have different... we have the possibility to have different polarizabilities for the two atoms or two different harmonics traps. But I agree that in principle, when we form a molecule and it's deeply bound and it's not just the sum of the polarizabilities, you are fully right. Yes. But normally we are not considering this deep bound part because it's not what our model is really interesting of. But it's a limitation, I agree. So we started out with two atoms in one optical lattice site, which looks like that, and we do the full calculation, and we get agreement with an experiment on the Hamburg people on the kilohertz level with this. So there is, however, a small problem with the exact value of the resonance, so to speak. But this is somehow the idea is that this calculation gives you more accurate information on the resonance than other techniques have given before. So in a way, you can make a consistency check. Yeah? But only with certain parameters you get a real convincing fit to the experimental parameters. So this was somehow for us, of course, an important check that the method seems to be sensefully implemented. Now, you all know, so I just repeat quickly, that there's a Bose-Hubbard model, and which is very popular in the ultra-cold atom community. So, of course, the key point, what you normally have, is your different parameters which you put in. And our question is, can we obtain those parameters not from the standard Vanier function, which assumes, so to speak, the full lattice, etc., but typically a delta function potential to really solve, especially U. But we want to have the real U calculated for a real Born-Oppenheimer potential curve, at least. Yeah? So what we do here is we use three lattice sites, two atoms. And now what we can do is we can solve the problem fully or within the Bose-Hubbard model. And then we can use this to find optimal Bose-Hubbard parameter by fitting, so to speak, the results to each other. We use three lattice sites to see the effect of the finiteness of the lattice. So we can check what happens here and what happens on the outside. And of course, we will get a range where Bose-Hubbard still works. However, you have to put some improved parameters. And then, of course, there will be some point which we can quantify where Bose-Hubbard will not work. You need more parameters to make it working. I mean, next neighbors or nearest neighbors, whatever. Yeah? On the course of this, and somehow evidently hidden in the paper, and therefore completely ignored already or almost, is that we found out that there's a very simple way to improve the interaction parameter without doing a full calculation, but checking it with a full calculation. And this is really from the Vanier functions, by assuming that what you really want to have is that your corrected U is a constant which has a correct slope at zero times the solution from the harmonic case, where you can, of course, know the solution completely. And this is somehow just the example on this. The black point is the optimized U. Red is for the Hubbard. And then you have the corrected one with a solid line. And of course, really important is in the case when you have really strong, large scattering lengths here, or you can, of course, make the lattice less strongly bound. What you then see is that Bose-Hubbard is completely off. The harmonic is still off. But this simple correction gives you a very good result compared with the full calculation. Which we, yeah?
So this you can do just with a single site, or you actually
Yes, this is a harmonic. Yeah, and this we have checked with a three site calculation. Yeah? Okay.
Sorry, can I just ask a different question? So you decide to use three in a line rather than a triangle.
Yes, because we have the orthorhombic thing, but
to exploit the axis of symmetry down the middle.
Yes,
or,
yes. But I agree we could have also thought about, of course, this situation. But it's a matter of just considering different things. But here, really, the idea was really to see what is the effect of the finiteness of the lattice. Yeah. So this was our main motivation here. Now, if you go to reduced dimensionality, there is a lot of interesting effects, as we know, so I don't have to repeat too many. But what we can do easily, for example, is we can really think, OK, we do not have to be really 1D or really 2D. We can be quasi 1D and quasi 2D as the reality is. So we can really show and calculate the fermionization of bosons, for example. Yeah. So what we have here is different tightness, so to speak, or different anisotropy of your trap. It's a one potential well in this case, but it's cigar shaped, so it's quasi 1D. Now we can change the anisotropy here. And as a result, you see that, of course, with a stronger and stronger 1D or quasi 1D situation, the wave function, although it's for bosons, gets more and more, I mean, like this blue one, I mean, from black to blue. And this you can compare with a solution for fermions. Yeah? And then you see why this bosonization or fermionization comes in. Yeah? So you see that the bosons are getting more and more pushed away from each other. And this is the radial density. Yeah? So things like this can be done with the code very easily. So the key point is we are not bound to real 1D, but we can do quasi 1D, quasi 2D symmetries. Yeah? Actually, for us, it's tough to make real 1D, of course, with this full code. I mean, 10 is already rather tough. Yeah? So going to an anisotropy of 100 or so is unpleasant with our approach. Okay, now I come to the topic, the main topic, confinement resonances. Now, confinement resonances is the following, or based on the following idea. So you take the relative motion S-wave scattering for two ultra-cold atoms in an harmonic quasi 1D confinement mapping of a, so you have a mapping of the quasi 1D system on a pure 1D system. That's the idea which was pushed forward by Olshani in a highly cited paper. And so what you get is an effective 1D interaction strength G1D. And if you look in the original paper, I think there's no mentioning of the resonance. But of course, in the follow-up paper, there was already said, okay, the well-known and so on, resonance described in this paper, because of course it's evident. If you look at this expression, and you now scale this A, which is the scattering length, or the transversal confinement, I mean the ratio, basically. Of course, because this is a constant, the theta function, there's a situation where this term becomes minus this one, and then evidently you get a blow up of your interaction. Okay? So this is just described here. So you get a going to infinity for this special situation. And this is supposed to be called the confinement resonance in the follow-up papers by Bergemann and Giolciani and so on. And also in 2D, the same effect was very quickly thereafter predicted by Petrov, Holtzmann, and Shliapnikov. The same situation happens, the same, I mean, it's not the same mapping, but effectively it will end up with a similar effect comparing to the confinement resonance. So that there is a divergence of this interaction strength possible for a certain confinement if you fix the scattering length, or inverse if you change the confinement for a fixed, you know, I said the same twice, but okay, you know what I mean. Now I have to tell you that there is, in this follow-up paper, unfortunately I didn't give the reference here, by Bergemann and Olshani, there is a picture which is horribly misleading if you do not really understand what they are doing. And this has been really somehow a very confusing part, because what they did is they said, okay, we can provide a kind of intuitive Feshbach resonance picture to this confinement-induced resonance. And what they say is, okay, you have your bound state and you have your trapped states. And now what you see is that the trapped states all are somehow get some pattern here, some pushing away pattern. Yeah, there's some slope and there's some here. And now if you shift this bound state by 2 h bar omega, you get this red curve. Or 4, you get the next one. And you see, this fits quite well, so to speak, where the slope changes. Yeah. So somehow, if you make this projection, they say, OK, you get where this crosses, you have your confinement resonance. And this actually is exactly at this value. So it's a very intriguing Feshbach picture. However, I have to warn you, in that paper, here's a reference. They also checked whether it's maybe an artifact of the delta function potential. So they used a number of short-range potentials. And now comes the important point. They did numerical calculations with these short-range potentials, and they are these symbols. And I tell you the main point you have to understand. There is no point on this shifted curve. This state is not an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian. It's not like the standard Feshbach picture where you say, okay, you have an Hamiltonian, you make a partitioning in H0 plus H1, and now if you forget about the coupling between the two, you get two sets of states, Now you introduce the coupling, and the crossings will be turning into avoided crossings. Yeah, that's the Fehrbach picture. Here, however, this state only exists if you project out of the Hilbert space of your Hamiltonian, because it's a different Hamiltonian. And so if you want to come back to your original Hamiltonian, you see you have to project back. And as I said, in the numerical calculation, it's clear you never get something here. Yeah? But this has been confusing people a lot. Now, of course, there was a hunt for these resonances because they are universal. Yeah, I mean, in the sense of if you are in the S-wave scattering regime, then, of course, you have a scattering length. And then the confinement length, yeah, the transversal confinement length, will give you a universal knob to get this at this resonance. Yeah, so you don't need a magnetic Fehrbach resonance or whatever to have a resonance. Of course, in practice, what the Innsbruck people did was the opposite. They used the magnetic Fehrbach resonance to tune the scattering length and kept the confinement constant. Yeah, but in principle, you could do the opposite way. Now, they did this, and they get the blue curve. First, which is the case that the two transversal directions are identically, have the same trapping frequency or the same confinement length. So it's isotropic in the transversal direction. So then you get this one, which is nice, because actually when you recalculate the thing, you find out this is approximately there, very accurately actually, where the confinement resonance should be. So hooray, they found the confinement resonance. Now, they write in their paper, at some point, to get this perfect agreement, they had to use a little bit an unusual choice where here they take where the resonance position is when they look at the loss spectrum. Yeah, it's not the usual position I always forget about. I think they took this one instead of this one, which they would normally have used. But this one perfectly fits with the Olchany theory. Now they did something which turned out to be very crucial. They changed the transversal symmetry, so they made it anisotropic in the transversal direction too, but only slightly. So it's still mainly confined transversely, but now the two directions are asymmetric. And now they get the red, or the with stronger anisotropy, the black curve. So what they see is the instead of one resonance, they get two, and the splitting increases. Now, they told me they, to get it through to PRL, they needed to have some theorists to help them, to have a model for that. And they got theory support, and they got the PRL. Now, the explanation of this splitting seems horrendously trivial. Of course, you have in the transversal direction, you have a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator in the first approximation. So if you make it anisotropic, you split the degeneracy. And of course, you will still expect, okay, why not having two resonances? However, first of all, they plotted here this splitting as a function of the anisotropy. And what they see is, what is rather surprising with the simple model I just said, is the splitting is not symmetric. From this, what I just told you, it should be really symmetric. But it's not. Yeah? And interestingly, they don't give any theoretical model calculation in this curve. Yeah, they didn't try to model it. They just argued.
Maybe it didn't fit.
Maybe.
What do you mean it's not symmetric? Just the upper slope?
Exactly. The upper slope is rather flat compared to the lower slope. So it seems like it is.
So the black curve is the experiment?
The black curve, sorry, forget about the red one at the moment.
So
this will be the next step.
Just
the experimental data. So now comes, however, the shock.
It looks to me like if you try to fit within errors, you could fit to.
You may argue this, but they were rather sure that it's not really working, because this should be still permanently above the error bar. But okay, you can argue this, of course, for sure. However, then there was a paper by Peng and Drummond and others doing the Olchany theory, and finding out that what Olchany theory, relative motion theory, predicts is this one. no splitting, and the slope not fitting to neither of the two curves. Okay? So, what has happened? What is going on? Now, the confusion became larger. There was this loss experiment. I mean, they measured the loss of atoms from their trap, from the Innsbruck group, from Haller et al., from Nagel group. Now, as I said, the position of the 1D CIR agrees with the Olshani prediction. The splitting does not, although it seems trivial. In quasi-2D, they measured also, but there's only a number, not a graph, so this is why it's not so fancy to show that. But there it's even worse, because they got the wrong sign for the resonance which was predicted by Petrov and Shliapnikov. So it was not only the wrong number, but it was on the other side. Yeah? And this was, of course, even more obscure. Now, they tried also, of course, they should look first on the correct side, in parentheses, and they didn't find losses. Now, to make it even worse, the Cambridge group of Michael Köhl, did a radio frequency experiment. And in quasi-2D, they find the CR exactly where it should be. Actually, Chris Wade also had found it, but he didn't report it because there was so much controversy and he was too close to Drummond telling him this is not possible and so on, but I don't know. Yeah, at least this is what he told me. Okay, nevertheless, the difference is really that they don't measure losses, but the binding energies with radio frequency association or dissociation. I don't remember now, sorry. Now, okay, we have our full apparatus, a highly motivated young PhD student starting, actually, no, sorry, it was a diploma student starting, saying, okay, let's go, run the machine. And think that, okay, of course, what we have is, they have these tubes in an optical lattice, so they have something which is, of course, not harmonic, and take the first correction to that. Take a sextic trap, yeah? Next order in the trap, so it looks like this, and you see, if you zoom in a little bit in, it's very well reproducing the correct optical lattice, the red one, while the harmonic one is these black dashes. Okay. Of course, only with the anharmonicity, that's important, you get a coupling between center of mass and relative motion. In a harmonic trap, relative motion only model, you will not. So now what do you get? The relative motion spectrum, which the student Simon got, looks exactly like we know it should look like. That's good. But okay, this can be done analytically. This has been done by Thomas Busch a long time ago, and in a very sensational diploma thesis, I would say. And now we do the full thing. You want to have a crossing? Okay. There are many. You know, there's a stupid joke about an older couple driving on the highway, and then in the radio they say, oh, there's a wrong way driver on the highway number 101. And the lady says to her husband, one? There are plenty. Okay, so which one is a resonance? And now you get even a very highly motivated student to be desperate. Because you have to consider, it looks maybe like avoided crossings, but you have to zoom in to be sure it's an avoided crossing. Yeah, and this doesn't look very promising. So,
couldn't you solve like in the one symmetry that you were sure that it was?
What we did is we made a model to guide us where to look. Exactly. So what we did is we did a model, and also for the coupling matrix elements by doing known approximate solutions. And what we found is that there's a kind of approximate selection rules. So most of these couplings are zero or almost zero. And actually, maybe with some feasibility argument on the Franconten factors, you find out that, and using, of course, the fact that we have an ultra-cold trap where everything is in ground state, we get, so to speak, that there's basically one state which should have a strong coupling. So we know where to zoom in, and we do that. So we go into the spectrum at the correct place, zoom in on a completely different scale, and really, there's the avoided crossing. There's one state which looks like not just going through, but that has to be like that. And there are states which have no avoid crossing. Even if you zoom in with many, many points here, you find out that at least it's very, 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 very narrow. So it's not really relevant for an experiment. So let's go further and take an anisotropic transversal confinement, and you see two. Actually, this is an older picture, so there's one where you see that this is not an avoid crossing. So these are the two avoid crossings. Okay. So this is the result. Experiment crosses. Blue is our model. Red is the Olshanian model. So we found this actually, to be honest, too good to be true. I mean, we have been really checking more than once because this was amazing.
can you go back one?
Yes.
Somehow, on if one looks at your left side, so from the left to the right, so
No, it's a different resolution. It's, as I said, unfortunately, this is not the correct picture, so to speak. We had, this was a lower resolution one, and we made later on a higher resolution one.
But it still looks like you should have a symmetric splitting. So where does the asymmetry come in?
No, it's if you calculate it, it's not, because it's really, I mean, the asymmetry comes, of course, from the slope, you could say.
But the slope is pretty much everywhere the same, or does
yes.
it just...
Yes, but it, from this scale, look at the scale of the width of the resonance, it makes an effect on this. It's, as I said, I mean, when one has to really see, we are speaking on a very... This is why I'm saying I'm really amazed that we got that, even quantitatively. And actually, very nice, it almost completely overlooked, because it's just a number in the paper, we also get perfect agreement for the quasi-2D case. So we get the correct sign and even the correct number to a very good approximation. So, okay, our conclusion is that there are actually two types of resonances. The elastic ones, predicted by Olshani, 1D, Petrov and Chlyapnikov, etc., in 2D, and inelastic ones. The elastic confinement resonance will not form molecules, therefore there will be almost no losses, and they are not seen in the Innsbruck experiment. The inelastic CIR, however, is a molecule formation, because what you do is you get rid of the binding energy by exciting transversal center of mass motion of the molecule. Yeah? So there is possibility to form molecules, and you have a loss. In quasi-1D, you have accidentally similar positions. In fact, they are overlapping because the Olshani resonance is so broad that it overlaps with the correct one. But the widths are different, one order of magnitude. And in quasi-2D, they even differ by the sign. And, okay, so I just want to emphasize that, of course, the possibility of creating molecules by the anharmonicity has been discussed earlier, starting with Paul Julien, with Eric Boulder, and Eitel Giesinger. And we ourselves, when we did the first three D calculations, said, oh, there are a lot of avoided crossings, and referencing to this paper, you can form molecules there. And there was also Kestner and Yuan coming up with this idea. Now, however, I have to say that not everyone is happy with our explanation. So actually, two out of three referees were not believing it until the end, and only the adjudicator was our help. Yeah, they were insisting that it's wrong. And because, I quote, there's no problem with the splitting of the 1D CIR, as its origin is evident and explained in the experimental paper. Yeah, we just make an asymptotic correction to that. Okay, explicit mass, like the one we repeatedly referred to in this paper, didn't bother the referee. Molecule formation from atoms requires free-body collisions. This is well known. So the authors are ignoring basic facts of physics. Okay? Okay, good. Now, another argument, maybe more serious, is that our ab initio calculations used the lithium-2 potential, because lithium has too many bound states. We didn't want to bother about this. But we assumed, of course, universality. And our model is, of course, not specific really for any system. However, there was a proposal that the losses could be due to cesium-specific Peshbach resonances, proposed by Peng and Drummond in that paper. It cannot be the splitting coming from the Olshani thing. There could be multi-channel CII effects, push forward by Melyshik and Schmelcher. And the losses in a many-body system, like in the Innsbruck experiment, are very unspecific, while the ones, the binding energies in Cambridge are so clean and showing and proving Petrov-Shliapnikov correct, that we must be wrong. Okay. Now, how can we experimentally test? Fortunately, there is a group, Selim Jochim, who has made a tremendous, nice experiment. Because what he can do is, he can prepare in a single trap potential a well-defined number of particles. So including exactly two. So no third body, no strange other effects. It's a very clean system with exactly two atoms. It's a perfect background. Side paths, they exactly use lithium by coincidence. So our ab initio potential curve which we used is exactly the one we should use. So first they confirmed the elastic CIR by measuring the tunnel rate, because then they have these distinguishable fermions, and what they do is, so to speak, they measure, of course, when you make U different from zero, of course this energy of this state will change, and as a consequence, your tunneling rate, which is exponentially depending on the barrier height, will change. So they measure directly the interaction energy, so they measure directly the binding energy, the way, but it's an on-site interaction energy, yeah, and see that they have a modified atomic tunnel rate exactly like it was predicted for the elastic CIR. However, they can also detect molecules by measuring the tunneling of atoms at a B field, which is sufficiently chosen that the deeply bound molecules cannot overcome the barrier in a sufficient fashion. So it's an ideal experiment, we thought, and we couldn't convince them. Actually, they had already started in this direction. And what they find is the following. They scan through the regime where the elastic CIR should be, centered here. They don't see anything there, also not in the whole width of that, except at two distinct positions. There they see, so to speak, indirectly molecules because they don't have losses of atoms, so they don't tunnel out anymore. Okay? So we do the full ab initio calculation for this problem. And we see, scanning it or zooming into the zoo, we see the two CIRs because they have an anisotropic transversal confinement. I mean, it's not perfectly 1D or quasi 1D. So it's fine, and we took this into calculation into account. And actually, they use this idea what Rempe has been using before in a different context. So they go in the middle of the avoided crossing suddenly, non-adiabatically. And then they create a superposition of the molecular state and the atomic state. And then they see a Rabi oscillation, Rabi type oscillation of the molecular formation if they vary the whole time. And exactly this experiment they do. And they see this oscillation. I'm sorry for the poor quality, but the next one will be better but smaller. So this is the Rabi oscillation they see. And from this, however, they can even get a better fit, or by varying now in this direction, so to speak, the magnetic field. So they get the width and the position even with more higher accuracy. And these are the numbers. So the position experimentally at Gauss is this value. We are slightly off, as you see. But the interesting thing is there's a general offset, because the difference between the two fits extremely well. And I would say, considering all the approximations still, and they don't know the potential that accurately, and we've checked that it's around in this regime of their uncertainty of the trapping potential, and our uncertainties, of course, it looks reasonable. The width is reasonable, not perfect, but I would say, I mean, the order of magnitude is definitely good. Yes?
Since we just got with someone the new model for lithium 2, did you use the new one or the with the new pole position by 2 Gauss shifted, or the old one?
We used the old one.
You think that might account for some of the differences?
I guess so.
That would be nice.
Yeah, because this is, I mean, this is three Gauss we are off. Yeah.
Ah, yes, okay.
This is 3.9 Gauss. So something around, of course, we would have to check this direction.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Maybe we are more off. We don't like you then anymore. No, I mean, I think, as I said, I think these numbers are, considering the efforts, tremendously good. I mean, I'm completely happy with that.
That's really nice.
Yeah. And so just to finish, so to speak, out, because I will not come to the other part as I expected, we did some recent extensions, so I make a little bit of commercialization. We did the solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, so we introduced time-varying optical potential. Now, so we've solved the full six-dimensional plus time Schrödinger equation. It's on the archive. We have a two-channel Bose-Hubbard model just submitted at a Feshbach resonance, and a single and Feshbach resonance model in ab initio time propagation, just as I said, submitted on the archive. We have included, or we have a calculation, and we are just finishing the manuscript hopefully soon, of two electron pairs or excitons, one exciton and one dot molecule, because we can, of course, also include Coulomb interaction. It's actually easier. And we have recently, actually a bachelor student, Bruno, has included the anisotropic dipolar interaction for polarized, so we have theta, so we have an anisotropic interaction too, so then we can soon answer your question. We have already first results for the harmonic trap, but also beyond. Just I want to give this result because of the discussion, this which was at the coffee break. So it's just to give a general and very preliminary and probably completely wrong result. So I mean, this number should be fine, but the interpretation is the question. So this is a narrow resonance, and this is a more broad resonance, the full spectrum with our model and the full calculation. So you see that the yellow line, for example, and the yellow dots are slightly different. There, our two-channel model is not perfect any longer. But this is a detail. Now, coming up to the question of what Michael and Lincoln have done on the question of the hopping of the molecules, this is a two-well potential. So of course, you can say, OK, the hopping parameter is directly given by the energy spacing of your two gross states. So we have to zoom in into this. And we have to analyze it more in this context. But what we see definitely is that for a narrower or a broader resonance, this splitting increases. I mean, from the going from a narrower to a broader resonance. So this would at least, the now extremely optimistic view, support your concept of a higher hopping rate of the molecules at a broad resonance due to the admixture of more higher block bands into the solution. OK, so with this, I just want to say what we are down doing is the three wells in dynamics, time-dependent dynamics, looking at fermions, bosons, distinguishable or non-distinguishable, and how they transport or hop in this very extensive lattice of three sites. Thank you very much.
So it seems to me the splitting of these confinement-induced resonance from your explanation is probably non-separability.
Yes.
Between the central mass motion and the relative motion.
Yes.
So I think in this case, then for a system of two heteronuclear atoms with one light and one heavy species, you would expect the splitting would be smaller because central mass motion separates better with the relative motion.
No, it's not separating better. I mean, this is part of the anharmonicity. I mean, this is what we always have to emphasize, that even if you have, I mean, the point is, of course, if you have heteronuclear atoms, I mean, considering the initial state, then, of course, if you have heteronuclear, then normally there are experiments where it's different, by a clever choice, but normally already the trapping potential is different. So you automatically have an anharmonicity or a coupling of center of mass relative motion, not due to anharmonicity, but due to the different trapping potentials, because then it doesn't separate any longer. It separates only if both atoms see the same harmonic potential. We have discussed this in the first paper. But the funny thing is, and this is why I'm a little bit hesitant to give you a direct answer, what we found in the first paper when we analyzed different situations where the center of mass and relative motion coupling occurs, it's not that predictable as one would have thought. So we thought, okay, if you do take lithium cesium or something like this, this will be giant, but it was not. So it's a number of issues, I mean, polarizability and mass ratio, which counteract. So I can only refer you to that paper where we made some examples and showed that the anharmonic coupling, the coupling of center of mass relative motion is not that easy predictable for us. Maybe you have a good explanation for our results. Yeah?
Andrew, it seems like now you can answer some of the questions that I was thinking about back in 2005 when I did that paper with Eric Boulder, that we basically calculated the decay rate of two molecules, yes, as it were, induced by the anharmonicity of a trapping cell. We did a model calculation on cesium. Of course, in those days, these experiments on cesium had not yet been done, so we didn't have anything, you know, we weren't comparing to those kind of situations. But your model, I think, could probably predict and compare with our predicted decay rates. Because we have a prediction for two cesium atoms in a lattice cell of about 40 recoils deep, up to 40 recoils deep. So the interesting question is what the time scale is for the decay. Exactly. We typically found the time scale was longer than seconds for typical lattices, and I'm just curious if your now good, proper model. We did a CI, but it was, of course, totally perturbative. It wasn't solving a big CI matrix like you're doing. We just took the perturbation term and got the over and moved the decay rate. So the question is that you can verify whether that's any good or not. So
I mean, the point is, of course, when you told me or mentioned this to me again, that you gave numbers. I mean, I actually checked that your paper is, according to Physical Review, 7 times cited. We are 4 of them. So at least. yes. But never mind that. No, but the point is we forgot about that we could do this check, I'm sure.
I'm just curious. Would it be like seconds and longer?
But I think that our simple model also gives already a very good prediction. So I'm sure probably your model is, we have to check whether it's not practically the same.
Okay.
Just reduce for reduced confinement.
Okay.
Yeah, or dimensionality. I don't know who is allowed to.
I